From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. You've probably heard about Brexit, but what about Blexit? The North Carolina State Director of a new group called Blexit explains the concept. It involves the so-called black exit from the Democratic Party. Count the UNC system's interim president among those concerned about North Carolina's ongoing state budget impasse. You'll hear his assessment of the impact on public universities in the state. North Carolina has taken initial steps toward cleaning up its criminal code. You'll learn why that's good news for one national reformer. He calls criminal law reform a necessary change. And we'll get an expert assessment of a recent settlement involving Duke Energy and coal ash. What are the environmental impacts? What could it mean for energy customers? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Could we be headed for a constitutional crisis over separation of powers as it relates to K-12 education in North Carolina? Well, that could be possible, says Dr. Terry Stoops of the John Locke Foundation. He's here to share the latest developments in a decades-old legal battle with a new development. Terry, of course, is Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies here at the Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Remind us, if you would, what the Leandro legal case is all about.
In 1994, parents and school districts sued the state, alleging that the state was not providing the type of educational opportunities in low-income districts that they believed those districts were entitled to. In 1997, the North Carolina Supreme Court ruled that students have a constitutional right to access to a sound basic education. After that ruling, the case was remanded to the trial court, which is where it remains today, and was overseen by a Superior Court Judge, Howard Manning. Manning retired, and another judge, David Lee, took his place overseeing the state's implementation of this constitutional requirement. So they oversee student performance and the various elements they have said contribute to ensuring that students have access to a sound basic education.
A little bit later, I want you to explain to us why it is that a case like this has gone on for year after year after year. In fact, the Leandro, Rob Leandro, the person that the case is named for and on his behalf, is like a middle-aged man at this point.
That's right.
He's an attorney. So we have a second judge that is now in charge of this case because, as you mentioned, Judge Manning retired. But Judge Lee now has the case. And just days ago, Terry, he issued an order. What's the new development in this case?
Well, what really changed was not necessarily Judge Lee's appointment, although he will definitely have a different style than Judge Manning had, but it was the decision by the plaintiffs and defendants to come together and to ask the judge to allow them to have an independent evaluator determine what is required for a sound basic education. And so they contracted with California-based consultant WestEd to write a report about the various things that North Carolina needed to do in order to ensure access to a sound basic education. The plaintiffs and the defendants agreed with WestEd's recommendations, and Judge Lee issued an order basically affirming the initial recommendations that WestEd provided. There are three phases of recommendations, just to give you a sense of how many there are, three phases of recommendations that are included in the 300-page WestEd report. Judge Lee essentially affirmed the phase one recommendations from WestEd in anticipation of future court actions.
Terry, could it be that down the road the judge will intervene and tell North Carolina legislators that they must, by court order, spend an additional amount of money on K-12 education? And if that's possible, doesn't that indeed set up a crisis of separation of powers based on the North Carolina Constitution?
Well, it's definitely possible, and we'll know more when the plaintiffs and defendants forward draft consent orders to the judge at the end of March for a possible court hearing in mid-April to discuss what that consent order may be. And in that order could be WestEd's recommendation that the state increase its educational funding by $8 billion a year, or $8 billion over the next 8 years, excuse me.
So roughly about $1 billion a year?
That's right.
Additional.
Additional. And so that would roughly double the state's current contribution to public education in North Carolina. That might very well happen, and that would absolutely be a constitutional crisis because our Constitution is very clear that it's the legislature that controls the purse strings. And so if the courts now get in a position of requiring the General Assembly to spend money on something, even if it's something that we all agree is important, like education, then there's a separation of powers issue that must be confronted. And I do have to remind listeners that we've had a separation of powers statute in the North Carolina Constitution since 1776. That is how fundamental of a concept it is to North Carolina's government.
What would happen if that occurred? Presumably the legislature, the leadership there would say, hey, wait a sec, with all due respect, Judge Lee, we're the people who appropriate the money, not the judicial branch.
Well, that might very well happen. And the real question is, do the courts really have a mechanism by which they can force the General Assembly to appropriate more money? There really isn't much of an enforcement mechanism for what we can tell, unless they somehow issue an injunction on the legislative session or something really dramatic. So the judge has been saying that he wants the General Assembly to be more involved in the case. It's worth noting that the General Assembly is not an intervener or a party to the case. They're on the outside looking in like the rest of us. And so he wants the General Assembly to be more involved in the case, but the General Assembly is asking a legitimate question. You want us to be more involved in the case, but you're also planning on ordering us to spend more money. That doesn't sound like cooperation. It sounds like coercion.
This issue of money, I think, is an interesting one, Terry, because you and I have talked many times about this. So our listeners to Carolina Journal Radio won't be surprised to hear that there isn't research that has that shows a direct causation between the amount of money that you spend and the outcome in terms of student achievement. So why is this case, at least for a lot of people, focused on money?
Well, it's focused on money because essentially the plaintiffs and defendants wanted it focused on money. And this is the real issue, is that since the courts have had oversight of the Leandro case, there hasn't been as much of a focus on money. Howard Manning would focus on many other things, and rightfully so, because of the importance of the various inputs and outcomes that these low-income districts have. So this is really a matter of the plaintiffs and defendants ensuring that they had a report that gave them a number. They were fishing for a number, and they got that number, and it's $8 billion over the next 8 years.
How is it possible this has gone on so long?
I'm asking myself that question every day.
You were a very young man when this started, and you started analyzing this.
That's exactly right. I'd like to think that I'm still young, but 25 years this case has been going on, and it's because it's in a strange situation. It has been remanded. It's in a special place in the court system. The judge is appointed to oversee the case. So it's not your typical case that runs through the courts and then ends once it gets to the wherever it's going, its last destination. This is just sort of hovering over North Carolina, as it has hovered over a lot of other states that have similar types of cases. This was a national campaign to try to use the courts to increase education funding. And so North Carolina is not alone in having a school funding case that is being overseen by the courts with no end in sight, that orders billions in extra spending.
in your analysis and writing about this case and K-12 education in North Carolina. Of course, all of that analysis available at johnlock.org and at carolinajournal.com. Terry Stoops, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. You've probably heard of Brexit, the long-discussed split of Great Britain from the European Union. Have you heard about Blexit? Well, if not, you'll want to listen to our next guest. Danielle Robinson is North Carolina's State Director for Blexit. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Mitch. I'm happy to be here.
So first of all, what is Blexit?
Okay, well, Blexit, hence the name, is the black exit from the Democratic Party. That's how our organization started, and the founder was Candace Owens. She started with a YouTube series that exploded on the scene called Red Pill Black, and that kind of birthed the movement of Blexit, which was in the form of Brexit. The idea was if the British are making their exit, then the blacks, we need to make our exit from core values that no longer are in line with what we believe.
You mentioned Red Pill. I'm guessing this is a reference to the Matrix and the characters in the Matrix sort
the
of
Red Pill figuring
out what the real world was.
Yeah, if you guys check it out, it's really dynamic because when she took that lead of saying, hey, what's going on here with the black community and how we vote and what our values are, you know, it was really kind of like groundbreaking. It's what drew me in as well.
What is it about the message that the community has been receiving from the Democratic Party that makes you think that it's time to have an exit, a Blexit from the Democratic Party?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mick. So the idea is with the fact that black people, we are increasing in our property ownership. We're increasing in the number of college graduates. We are increasing in our small business property ownership, even legal gun ownership. And also the fact that for many of us, our Christian values are still important to us. When we took a look at that, we started realizing, or it became readily apparent, that the left no longer stood for those values that were traditionally important to us or where black people were going. So they no longer represented that, and it was time to go.
You mentioned that Candace Owens was the first person who really got this ball rolling. Now it has come to North Carolina. We mentioned at the top, you are the North Carolina State Director, so there are more than just you, a number of people in North Carolina who are interested in this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's something really to be proud of because pretty much North Carolina is leading the way when it comes to this black exit. And the idea behind it is pretty much, you know, with the left no longer representing our values, it's still for over the last 30 years, they could count on 80% of our vote. So the question became, you know, why is that? And it's because we didn't realize that we were stuck in a pattern. We never did a reconciliation. We never did sort of like a systems check to say for who we are right now and where we're going, does this line up? So the fact that, you know, North Carolina Blexit is starting here, we're leading that charge. And I like to think of it as, you know, with the way the left engaged us, think of it sort of like a Super Bowl commercial. you know, all hype, no substance. You know, their principals, you know, they are increasingly poor. They have an increasingly poor product, and pretty much the black community is no longer buying. So to have North Carolina kind of lead that, it's a really big deal, because in our community, this is pretty much the equivalent of a revolution.
We are chatting with Danielle Robinson, who is North Carolina's state director for Blexit. So we get the point. It's the black exit from the mm-hmm. Democratic Party. What's next? I mean, I'm guessing some people would say, so are they all going to now jump to the Republican Party, or is it a case of now weighing your options?
Okay, so the key thing that we are looking to do with Blexit is actually create more civically informed people. And when I kind of mentioned the Super Bowl, it's the idea that, you know, the left always engaged us with propaganda, never any facts. They never said, okay, let's take a look at how these policies have affected our community. And Blexit is going to really shed light on that, because we're going to put the propaganda aside. And then what we're also going to do is give a fair approach to, you know, conservative values that black people tend to have inherently, excuse me.
Right.
So it's the idea that, you know, on one hand, we've traditionally voted, you know, Democratic without thinking. But at the same time, we've not had anyone kind of give a safe space to just kind of have us look at our values and see where our values line up. And I think one thing right now with the extremes that we find our society on, we need someone that just can kind of say, and which our organization will do, here, take a list here, you know, look at your values. Look at what's important to you. And if you find yourself not in alignment with what you believe is important, there's a safe space to break away. And that's what we're trying to encourage. So we're excited about the rallies that we're having. We're excited about the educational programs that we're having. We're excited to just have the forums of, you know, being able to ask the questions of how do we do this? How do we see if, you know, we need to switch, you know, who we support or what we represent or where we're going. That's the community. I mean, that's the conversation that Blexit is creating the safe space to kind of have.
Sounds as if you and others who are working on this want to get a lot of good information before you make decisions, rather than just say, we're going to vote for this party or we're going to switch our allegiances and vote for the other party. We want to know what both parties or all parties stand for before we give anyone our allegiance.
Yeah, very much so. Because if you pretty much look at it, even right now with the idea of fake news, it's pretty much an information war. It's how do we get the information to people in a way that aids them to make a decision without the bias. Our community has been, it's just like, you know, every time there's, you know, visits to our churches or visits to our communities, it's just like a flyer, you know, something put up on the door, vote this way. Well, why? Does it benefit me? No one has stopped to ever, you know, create the space for us to engage in those conversations. It's always been, you know, do this because we've always done it. And right now, Blexit is kind of pulling people back from that and say, we have the information to help you make those decisions. And when you make those decisions and find out that it wasn't what you thought, there's a whole community of people that have broken away and made that shift. And we're here to kind of encourage you and support you through it.
Sounds as if your group is willing to do some work to learn more about the issues, but also anyone who's trying to approach your group to get their support is going to have to work hard in terms of providing accurate information. This is not going to be an easy thing. Anyone who's going to be taking part in this is going to have to work hard to show that they have the right answers.
That's right. I mean, on both sides, it's work. It's work because, you know, and even one of the reasons why, you know, as Blexit, we appreciate the John Locke Foundation, because right now we want to take good research and data and get that in the hands of our community. That's not always been done or even ever been done. It's always been slants that have been, you know, prioritized towards, you know, we talk a lot about identity politics in the news. We talk a lot about things that when you think about it, we don't get the facts behind it before we're pushed to vote for it. So we're getting this information out. People are partnering with us to get the good information out, to have the forums and the community events, even school choice. Like, I think a lot of people do not even realize that within the Black community, educating our children is so important.
And your website address again?
www.ncblexit.com.
That is the voice of Danielle Robinson. She is North Carolina State Director for Blexit. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Count the interim president of the University of North Carolina system among those who are disappointed that state lawmakers and Governor Roy Cooper have deadlocked over a new state budget. The university continues operations under budget provisions that were scheduled to end last June. During a recent meeting, Dr. William Roper spelled out the impact of the budget impasse on UNC.
The lack of a state budget for the current fiscal year is a source of great frustration, real disappointment, and deep concern that this will hurt our institutions, our faculty, our students, and the communities we serve. Without a new state budget in place, we'll be unable to pursue major capital projects and much-needed infrastructure repairs. Enrollment growth, particularly at the NC Promise institutions, will go unfunded. Faculty and staff will not receive raises, which means our institutions will be much less competitive when it comes to retaining and hiring the best talent. And let me just pause and say, of course, I get it that North Carolina is a state divided politically. And of course, I know it's an election year. But you and others have long described this UNC system as the crown jewel of our state. And I ask you, and through you, ask our state's leaders, please don't make this system collateral damage in this year's political standoff. And finally, if I may put it this way, people have long said how much they support the system. And I ask you, please spare us the platitudes. Just get the budget done. Everyone wants to know, when will this budget deal get done? Obviously, none of us knows the answer to that. But it looks like it's April at the earliest, if ever. There's no getting around the fact that the impasse in Raleigh is going to hurt. But the UNC system is resilient. Through collaboration, we will work to find ways to make sure the current crisis does not do irreparable damage to our institutions. But let me be very clear. We don't have a reserve here at the system office to cover what otherwise would be funded. And so please don't ask us to do that. We simply don't have the money.
That's UNC System Interim President William Roper speaking recently to the University System's Board of Governors. Roper was discussing the impact for UNC of a state budget stalemate. It stretches back to last summer. In addition to Roper's comments, the governing board sent a resolution to lawmakers. The BOG asked legislators to finalize some new budget deal. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina is taking the first steps toward a possible rewrite of the state's criminal code. One person who would like to see that happen is Jim Copeland, a North Carolina native and New Bern resident. Copeland is also senior fellow and director of legal policy at the Manhattan Institute. Why should we be paying attention to the criminal code?
The criminal law is really the foundation, to some degree, of why we're worried about expansive government and why we support limited government. The ability to take away someone's life or liberty and put them in prison is sort of the core issue that we're worried about, even more so than tax and regulation and these other sorts of things. The second thing is, if we're going to do that, then people really need to be on notice for what's criminal. We don't want to be locking people up for making innocent mistakes. And it's sort of an old maxim in the American law and the Anglo-American law that that ignorance of the law is no excuse. But that was before we had 300,000 federal crimes, and I don't know how many state crimes there are in North Carolina. We couldn't really quite figure it out, but there's so many, and they go beyond the criminal code. They go beyond the statutory code itself into all sorts of other areas of law, that if we really want people to be able to comply with the law, we ought to make it easier to understand what that law is and really try not to punish the innocent people who are trying to run a family farm or a small business but inadvertently making a mistake based on the volume of law that's out there.
You've looked at criminal issues across the country. How does North Carolina compare?
The good answer for North Carolina is all the states are equally bad in this to some degree. Every state has many multiples of crimes in their state criminal code that goes beyond the model penal code. Every state has hundreds of thousands of pages of crimes. Every state has some form of delegation of crime creation to regulatory agencies or municipalities or private bodies at some level. North Carolina is an outlier in terms of creating more felonies. North Carolina's just been creating a higher percentage of felonies. So that's a problem given the collateral consequences for being a felon. You lose the right to vote. You lose the right to bear arms. It's much harder to get a job. So that's something that we found particularly worrisome in North Carolina. But all the states have problems along these areas.
If people don't know they're committing a crime and don't even have a reason to think they might be committing a crime, what kinds of problems does that cause?
Well, I think it's a really big problem. I mean, if you look at the totality of the statute books, because the majority of crimes, two-thirds of the crimes in North Carolina, most places, are not in the criminal code itself. The criminal code itself is much bigger than it needs to be. There's a lot of crimes out in the statute books beyond that. And then you'd have to go through each municipality's ordinance, depending on where you are, to decide what's a crime. You'd have to look through the regulatory codes in public health and environment and agriculture. You'd have to look through the sort of standards set by the guilds in areas like nutrition or dentistry or what have you to know that you're not violating these crimes. So innocent people are getting wrapped up in the law. And sometimes they're being good neighbors. Sometimes they're just running a business, but they don't know what size box they're supposed to use or what form they're supposed to fill out. Now, I do think, let's be fair, I do think most prosecutors are trying to do a good job. Generally, they're not trying to just ensnare people who are unknowingly committing these sorts of violations. But we have seen North Carolina litigate this up to the U.S. Supreme Court when it came to private businesses trying to set up a teeth whitening kiosks that created a conflict for the dentists. I mean, the dentists obviously don't want competition. This is very profitable for them. The question is this a real public health concern or not? And the state legislature is not even weighing in on it. All they're doing is saying, well, whatever standards the dentists come up with on their own are the standards, and if you violate it, you're committing a crime. So these are real problems. We've had individuals in North Carolina who set up a blog, diabetics, said, this is what I did to try to fix my own diet. Get in trouble with the state over this because they weren't complying with the nutritionist's rules, etc. They were trying to practice dietetics without a license or whatever the rule is. So these are real issues that can ensnare real people.
We're speaking with Jim Copeland, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. It should be easy to fix this problem, right?
It's not easy to fix, unfortunately. You could put in prophylactics. In other words, you can say we're going to let people fight back if they make an innocent mistake, or we're going to require various criminal intent. But without even knowing what all the rules are, what all the crimes are, we don't know what all the unintended consequences would be of doing that. So what North Carolina's done, a little different from some of the other states, and I think it's to their credit, but they're just getting the ball rolling on it, is to try to say we need to figure out what we've got. We need to look at all these crimes. We need to recodify this. We need to try to understand the problem first and simplify it. But given how vast the criminal code is, but the overall statute books are, and all these sort of subsidiary regulations and ordinances that have criminal teeth are, it's a big effort and a big lift. And I'm hoping North Carolina can stick with it. It would really be a model for the nation if North Carolina can get this done.
What would it mean for North Carolina to finish the work of cleaning up the criminal code?
I think it would show that it can be done. I mean, part of the reason why this hasn't happened is everyone just says it's just impossible. Now, no other states have done various things. Some states, we've worked with Ohio and Michigan, and they set up default criminal intent standards to try to protect the innocent folks who are getting ensnared by some of the rules. And that seems to have worked reasonably well. Other states, Kansas has an office of the repealer, trying to repeal old crimes. Minnesota had an un-session trying to take crimes off the books. And so those things can work to some degree, but you're maybe just getting low-hanging fruit when you do that, and you're not necessarily recodifying everything and simplifying it and streamlining it. It's very difficult to do. It's not the sort of thing the average legislator is going to go home with and say, vote for me, we did this, because nobody's really getting an immediate benefit from it, but it's really important. And so if North Carolina does it and shows it can be done, you know, other states, I think, will follow.
I work at the John Locke Foundation. You work at the Manhattan Institute. Is this just some crazy right-wing scheme?
It's one of these things that cuts across, I think, both party labels and ideologies. There are areas of the criminal law that are going to be more controversial. What do we do about narcotics and drugs? What are we going to do in terms of bail and incarceration and imprisoning people when they're violent criminals, the murderers, the rapists, the assaulters? I mean, people don't want those folks running out on the street, but there's disagreement. There's disagreement between conservatives and libertarians on these sorts of things. But this is really different. This is about fundamental notice and who's getting hurt the most by these sorts of regulatory crimes, particularly at the state level. It's the small business owner. It's the sole proprietor. It's the family farmer. This isn't about saving white-collar criminals who work at giant corporations, because those giant corporations have compliance teams. They sometimes break the law, but it's hard to argue that they're not knowing when they're doing it. They may be trying to skirt the law and skirt the legal rules, but by and large, they're reviewing it with their in-house lawyers or their outside counsel. The average sort of person out there doesn't have that. And so these sorts of small business owners that are doing this, these family farmers, I mean, these are disproportionately people who have less education, disproportionately are going to be minorities or women or people who aren't working at big businesses and things like that. That's who's often getting ensnared by these rules. So I'm hopeful that this is the sort of thing where you might actually see the atypical bipartisan compromise.
That's Jim Copeland. He lives in North Carolina, but works as a senior fellow and director of legal policy at the Manhattan Institute. He's touting the benefits of criminal law reform. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Now that Governor Roy Cooper's Department of Environmental Quality has ordered Duke Energy to excavate its remaining coal ash sites, the cost of cleanup has risen significantly, and it's leading to all sorts of questions about who will end up paying for this and about Governor Cooper's changing view on that subject. Don Vandervaart is the senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He, of course, is a scientist and the former secretary of DEQ during the Pat McCrory administration. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coal ash. That is the residue from using coal to produce energy. And our listeners may recall a few years ago, there was a spill of some of this into the Dan River, and that really brought the issue to the forefront. So what has the state now told Duke it must do?
Right. So coal ash presents really two different kinds of problems. One is the one manifested Dan River, which is you've got a structural failure, in that case, due to a lack of maintenance by Duke, and that caused the leak into the river. So that's a structural issue. Then the second is simply the potential that groundwater is somehow contaminated by storing the coal ash underground or in the ground. So years ago, under the McCrory administration, the legislature passed the Coal Ash Management Act, and that gave DEQ the authority to tackle this issue. And the act also defined a certain number of coal basins to be dug up, but it left six as what they called low risk. And those low risk basins could still have been dug up, or they could be kept in place and capped and drained. But it was up to the department to do that, and the risk was such that the time schedule, the time frame was later. And so this is where we are now. In a sort of an abrupt announcement last year, the department said all six of those remaining basins had to be completely excavated, which is the most extreme and most expensive option. Duke had proposed a number of ways of dealing with it, but they were far less expensive, and they included draining most of them and capping them in place. Duke, of course, was concerned. They have a duty to give us low-cost electricity, and so they filed a lawsuit against DEQ. And that's where it should have progressed. They should have, a judge would hear the two sides, and the science would win out, and whatever came out of that presumably would have happened. Okay, enter in the special interest environmental groups. They, of course, for various reasons, and they're led by their law firm called the Southern Environmental Law Center, they want to just dig everything up. And they're not really all that concerned with the science. It just says that's the best solution, and there's certainly some arguments against that. But that's what they wanted. And so they had filed a lawsuit as an ongoing lawsuit. So what happened then was that there was a settlement, and this settlement resulted in not all the coal ash being excavated, but more importantly, it dealt with who was going to pay.
That brings us to the nut of the question we want to talk about here today. First of all, how expensive is this likely to be, and who is going to pay for this?
Right. So as a result of the excavation that was dictated by the Coal Ash Management Act, which was, as I said, passed under Governor McCrory's administration, the costs were already pegged at about $4 billion. The costs associated with digging the rest of this, the remaining coal ash basins, would have been $5 to $6 billion more. The settlement, as I said, left about 30% of the coal ash in the ground. And so the estimates I'm seeing is something around the order of $4.5 billion more dollars.
That's pretty much double then.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. But the questions, to me are, well, wait a minute. I thought there are many, but one of them is, well, wait a minute. I thought the department wanted said that the science dictated that everything had to be dug up. And that's not the case. So I didn't understand, what was revealed that maybe the department didn't know about. But probably the most important facet is that the department, which was representing the state of North Carolina, agreed in the settlement to those provisions that will absolutely bring those costs to the customer.
So you and I, who are a Duke Energy customer, when you get your bill, you're going to see, as part of your bill now, these cleanup costs.
You're going to see them as manifested in higher rates. It won't say, due to settlement signed by Governor McCrory, Governor Cooper's administration, but it'll be higher. What's surprising about this is that in 2014, Governor Cooper was very adamant. At that time, Attorney General Cooper was very adamant that those costs should be borne by the shareholder, not by the customer, and even was pushing for legislation that would prohibit passing these costs on to the customer.
As I recall, there was a number of news stories actually written about that and really casting then Attorney General Cooper as the protector of the consumer.
No question. And now if you fast forward to the settlement, there's actually language in the settlement where DEQ and the special interest environmental groups say that this excavation is reasonable, prudent, and in the public interest, which is the requirements for passing it along to the customer. In addition, they actually sign on to in the settlement that they pledge they will not challenge Duke when they bring this reimbursement to the Public Utilities Commission. They won't challenge that. They won't argue. And this is what's so surprising. I saw an article just recently in the Daily Target, I believe, where somebody from one of those special interest groups that bemoaned the fact that the customer may have to pay for this. Well, his group signed on to the very language that will ensure that will happen. So it was kind of surprising. It was surprising that Cooper did the 180, and it was kind of hypocritical for some of these environmental groups to act like they didn't understand what they signed. And I'm still not sure I understand why the DEQ, after having said the science dictates all the coal ash should be excavated, has now settled for some 30% less than that.
Yeah. So in addition to the big time question about the change in Roy Cooper's view on who should pay from 2014 when he was AG to now, his right. Department of Environmental Quality saying, well, yes, the people who get the bills will see that in increased rates. There's the question about the science. So what happens from there if the science really doesn't dictate this type of settlement?
So Duke wants this settlement to become a court order. That'll solidify their position to make sure the customer pays for it. But there may be customer groups that can challenge that settlement. Right now it's out for public notice. We don't know if that's going to happen. But if someone were to challenge that, you would then potentially see the unfurling of the reasoning behind the settlement in a court context.
And if indeed that happens, we will have you back to talk about what is revealed in any of those documents or those hearings. We're talking with Don Vandervaart. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. By the way, he writes and talks about these issues, as does our Director of Regulatory Studies, John Sanders. And you can find all of that analysis at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Don, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you will join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.